You don't have to travel far to see solar panels and modern windmills creating electricity from the sun and the wind. But even after years of building renewable energy, as in not burning things to create electricity, still makes up a relatively small percentage of our total power generation. How high could that number get? 80%, says one recent research paper. And with some more work on storing power created by renewables, the number could go higher. One of the biggest factors, the weather. The research comes from scientists at the University of California, Irvine, the California Institute of Technology, and the Carnegie Institution for Science. That is where we find Ken Caldera, a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So this is less about technology than about weather. Talk about the parameters of what you set out to study here.
First, I should say that there have been several studies previously, one by the Department of Energy and one by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, that concluded that any individual location, there's too much variability in wind and sun to really power yourself reliably with wind and solar. I mean, if you look at your weather today, it's rainy, snowy up where you are,
mm-hmm.
and the solar panels are just not generating very much electricity, but people still want to listen to their radios or stream over their computers. And so a number of people have looked into this idea of having kind of a interstate highway of an electric grid. Right now, I mean, for example, it's probably pretty windy in Iowa or upper Midwest, but there's no real way to get that electricity here to California or to New York. And so a number of researchers have been looking at, how would it help renewable power to have what's called a high-voltage DC grid, a real sort of superhighway system of electric grid. And then if it's not windy here in California, well, maybe it'll be windy in Maine, and all this kind of variability would average out. And so we did a study looking over a 36-year period using historical data. And well, how far could you push renewables, in particular wind and solar, if you had such a superhighway of the electric grid? And it turns out that there are certain periods where, for a couple of weeks, almost the whole country has very little wind. And so, even when you average the amount of sun and wind over the whole country, there's still substantial variability. So we concluded that you could really get the vast majority of our electricity from wind and solar, but you still have to deal with those periods where maybe it's nighttime and just it's pretty calm through the whole country.
So this is not about determining if you could get decent wind power out of Wyoming, which you probably can, and decent solar power to Southern California, but it really takes a more holistic look at the whole country.
Really, when I first started getting into this, I thought, oh, the best thing would be let's start, take an island, maybe Hawaii or something, and make a little island be completely renewable energy. And it turns out that that's the hardest thing to do, because one island, you just have whatever the wind and sun is right there. And really, the bigger the area, the better it is for wind and solar. And so, I mean, actually, the United States is in a pretty good position because we're such a big country that, usually it is the case that if it's not windy in one place, it's windy somewhere else. And so if you can move electricity from one place to another, it really helps intermittent renewable energy like wind and solar a lot. And also, I mean, with solar power, obviously Arizona and New Mexico are great for solar, and Maine and New York City are not so great for solar. But right now there's no way to get that electricity from Arizona to New York. So really, getting this national electric grid could really help. And the other thing that these studies have shown, it used to be, 10 years ago, the story was completely different because wind and solar was so expensive, especially solar, that, it seemed crazy if you'd say, oh, let's do the whole country with solar. But the cost of solar panels have come down dramatically over the last decade. And now, so this kind of system with an electric, big national electric grid that's mostly powered by wind and solar would be no more expensive than what we have right now. And so it's really been a real sea change in the costs of these technologies.
Ken Caldera is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's one of four authors of a piece of research called Geophysical Constraints on the Reliability of Solar and Wind Power in the United States in the journal Energy and Environmental Science. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 as we talk about the limits of renewable energy based on the kinds of weather we get. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Ken, are we close to the, I mean, do we have the kind of technology you're talking about to make a grid that would be that smart and that efficient to be able to allocate things the way that would they would need to happen?
Yes, so this is all existing technology. In fact, the Chinese are building these kind of grids in China right now, and they have plans to basically build a global scale high voltage electric grid. And you know that is just sort of it was a book written by the head of the main electric company in China, and he laid out what his plans are for a global grid, but they're doing it in China now. And so, you know, other countries are moving ahead with these technologies, and the United States is unfortunately at risk of becoming a backwater when it comes to deploying these technologies.
Well, that sounds a bit sad. I mean, so the technology exists, it's just that we haven't chosen to deploy it. Do we still think regionally in ways that other countries, perhaps the size of China, don't? I mean, we still have individual power companies, it seems like, mostly state by state.
Yeah, in Europe, for example, the whole Northern Europe is pretty well integrated. And so the reason why, say, Germany can have a lot of wind power is that they're connected up the electric grid in Norway and so on. And so when the wind's not blowing, they can get water from hydropower from Norway, and that integration, and the same thing with Denmark and their wind. And so having this, all this hydropower in Norway can allow Denmark and Germany and so on to have lots of wind. Also in China, as I said, they're building lots of wind and solar and connecting it together with these grids. Whereas in the United States, it's just really hard if you want to build a new power line, just the permitting town by town and property owner by property owner is really difficult. And, you know, nobody also wants wind turbines in their backyard. Democracy is great, and it's, you know, great to have local control, but, you know, when you have a centralized control like there is in China, you know, the leaders of the country can just say, we're going to build this, and they just go ahead and build it. And, you know, I mean, obviously there are people who live nearby these power lines that are not happy about it, but in the United States, the people who are not happy about it have power to stop it often, but in China they don't. And so, anyway.
So let's get to some of the numbers here, because we mentioned at the outset that you foresee the possibility of getting 80% of our electricity needs from renewables. I do want to get to that in a moment. I want to mention it first. But the amount of data that you guys went through, 36 years worth of climate or weather information?
Yes. Every day, you know, there are weather reports done by the National Weather Service, but they collect all that data that goes into making those weather forecasts, and then take a big model of the weather system and ingest all of that weather station again, and then make estimates of what people think the weather was over the last 36 years. And so that, what we use to drive our simulated wind turbines and solar panels, and we looked at if we use the optimal mix of wind and solar, how much could we smooth out the variability? Because in many places, like here in California, it's obviously sunnier in the summer, but it tends to be windier in the winter. And so if you have a mix of wind and solar together, it smooths out some of that variability. So there's really three sources of variability. There's, first of all, our demand goes up and down. So typically we want more electricity in 2 in the afternoon than at 2 a.m. in the morning. And so its variability of demand, and then there's variability from the winds and variability from the sun. And somehow you have to fill the gap between this variable demand and variable sources of electricity, and that's where storage comes in. And today, we're not really relying on storage. We're relying largely on natural gas. And so, we don't have that much penetration of wind and solar, but when the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining today, it's mostly natural gas. And in the Pacific Northwest, of course, there's a lot of hydropower, but on a national scale, it's mostly natural gas that's filling up that gap. And so if we had a lot more wind and solar, that gap would be much smaller. But it kind of gets hard towards the end, even with this national grid, to get that last 20%.
So in other words, 80% is fairly easily obtainable with technology on hand now. But the last, between 80 and 100%, that's where it gets really tricky?
Yeah, we had a meeting last summer on this question of the last 20%. And, I mean, mostly we've been discussing the electricity grid, but half of the energy in this country is not used for electricity, but it's used for heating and also for cooling somewhat, but mostly for heating. And that's not only heating homes and offices, but also industrial processes like making steel or making cement. And making steel and cement with solar and wind reliably, that's a tough nut. And so there's definitely a need for technology development, but I think the message is that there's plenty that we can do today with today's technology. So, I mean, our paper was a scientific and technical analysis, but, I have my own political opinions, and my own opinion is that we should get going and seriously building this national electric grid and deploying as much wind and solar as we can today. And while we're doing that, we need to work on the technologies for the end game. But the concern about not understanding how we're going to do the end game shouldn't stop us from our opening move.
So move to get to the 80% now, and we'll deal with the other 20% as the technology comes along. Ken Caldera is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science, one of four authors of a paper on the geophysical constraints on the reliability of solar and wind power in the United States. The good news, we can get to 80%, he thinks, with a revised grid. It's that last 80 to 100% that could be a little more tricky. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments about converting over to renewables and what the possibilities are there. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jamie in Medford dropped a question off. He wants to ask about what potential you see in tidal energy, and I believe he's talking about geothermal as well.
Yes. First of all, the more different sources of energy that you can get that are uncorrelated, the better off you are. And so if you can get some energy out of tidal energy, well, that's not going to be related so much to the wind and sun. And so if you can do it, do it. Unfortunately, there's really just a few places where tidal energy works well, like the Bay of Fundy. I forget where that is, Nova Scotia. And there's a few other places in the world. But in most places, just the tides are not enough of a difference between high tide and low tide to make a difference. Another idea is wave energy. And that's good, but if you think most, it might be good right along the coast, but it's really not enough power and waves to power the entire country. And geothermal, there are places like here in California, there's the geysers area that does geothermal energy. And there's really not that many places where hot enough rock is near the surface and it's too expensive to drill down deep. And so right now, just sort of on a cost competitive basis, in most places, wind and solar is likely to beat out geothermal.
And so with the issue of storage, we haven't really explored much yet. I mean, if we were to get to being able to provide 100% of our needs with renewables, storage would have to be part of that picture to get us above the 80% that's sort of laying there out for us, right?
Yeah, well, we're doing a study on storage right now. And, one of the issues is, let's say you have a little battery that's just kind of smoothing out one gust of wind to a next. You might be using that, 100 times a day. And so over 365 days, you're using it tens of thousands of times per year. But if you're trying to just worry about that one time every year when, you know, there might be a day with no wind through the whole country, you know, now you're having all that storage and you're just going to use it once a year, and that gets really expensive. And so finding a cheap way for doing that, and, you know, what the cheapest way might be if we could figure out better just how to manage loads, you know, that right now if there's a blackout and a brownout, that's like a bad thing. But, you know, maybe, you know, so some of it's probably just, you know, if we could figure out ways to run our dishwasher in the middle of the night instead of the middle of the afternoon, or maybe our refrigerator cools down more when electricity use is low, and then, you know, stops cooling in the middle of the afternoon. And so so storage is a big thing, and we definitely need more and cheaper storage. But another idea, which is kind of a form of storage, is, you know, sometimes when you have lots of wind and solar, you're making more electricity than you need. And so one idea is, well, maybe we can make hydrogen or some other fuel from that electricity when there's an excess of wind and solar, and then maybe burn that hydrogen later when the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining. But all of these technologies today are pretty expensive, and we could do that. But the challenge is, you know, people don't want to see their electric bills doubling. And so, you know, can you do this stuff without increasing people's electricity bill? And it's thought that it's like 80% of wind and solar we could do today without increasing people's electricity bill.
It seems like most of the technology for storage, too, whether we're talking about, you know, things like switches that bring batteries in and off when needed, and pumping water up mountainsides, for example, to let it run back down through turbines at night. These are all things that involve some transfer from one physical state to another, which I'm sure takes up a fair amount of energy itself.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, pumped hydro is really the cheapest long-term storage. This is this idea where you have a reservoir, and, you know, when you have extra electricity, you pump water up into that reservoir, and then when you need it, you run it through the dam and generate electricity. But the biggest pumped hydro facility in the United States, if it's running at full capacity, only provides electricity for 4 hours. And so it's thought by most people who've looked at this that these kind of energy storage technologies, you know, would be really good for sort of smoothing out the kind of day-night cycle, or maybe if one day is, you know, is calm and cloudy, but, you know, this thing where you either have a couple of weeks without much wind, or you're trying to bring solar power from the summer to the winter, you know, that's where it gets really tough, and there's no good solution. And also, I mean, the environmental movement largely began over the Storm King Mountain that was planned to be a pumped hydro facility near Bear Mountain in the Hudson River in New York. And you know, it's a beautiful landscape. And people said, how could you build this, you know, this pumped hydro facility in this beautiful place? I mean, even today, there's the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir out in the Sierra near Yosemite. And that used to be a beautiful valley like Yosemite. And they built a big reservoir there that I get my water from, and San Francisco gets its water from. You know, that was considered an environmental disaster at the time it was built. And so, you know, I mean, one of the problems, this is, you know, again, the problem, you know, in the United States, people are, you know, are more empowered than in a lot of other places in the world. And that's generally a good thing. But it also means that it's kind of hard to build anything here. And so we tend to be kind of locked into the status quo.
So hard to move ahead. Ken Caldera is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from the Carnegie Institution for Science. About 3 minutes left. Here's a call from Cynthia in Talent. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yeah, I'm just wondering who funded your research and who will benefit from the, you know, who will benefit financially from this proposed new grid. My own thinking is that there's a lot more security for folks to have microgrids and local control, and even just pairing with neighbors for solar, which I've done successfully. But the power company is very resistant to that kind of thing. I know that in Puerto Rico, they are trying to rebuild with more security by having microgrids. So just that's my comment.
Okay, micro versus macro. Thanks for that, Ken.
Yeah, well, let me address the funding issue first, because that's a legitimate question. And that my funding comes primarily from two sources. One is I work for Carnegie Institution for Science, which has an endowment, and some of the proceeds from the endowment funds my work. And then I'm also the recipient of philanthropic funds, and that's primarily from Bill Gates. And you know, and I can tell you that at least 5 years ago, he was very skeptical about wind and solar and fairly much a proponent of nuclear power. And so my funding sources are in no way related to the results that we've obtained. Microgrids make a lot of sense in a lot of places. I have friends who do work in Africa, and where you're off-grid, and if you can put a community together on a microgrid, that is a big advantage over sort of each person having their own rooftop solar. And so microgrids can play a role, but, you know, just I understand your weather today is a little nasty.
Yeah.
And you know, if you think you have a microgrid and you have your solar panels, you're not going to be generating much solar power today. And if you were hooked up to some grids in the deserts of Arizona, that you would be getting that electricity from Arizona. And so, you know, I really don't care. I'm a big fan of whatever works.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if microgrids are the right solution and you know, if you're in Puerto Rico, you know, that you'd probably like a Puerto Rico scale grid. But typically for renewables, it's usually advantaged just to be as big as you could get.
Okay. 80% is what we think we can get with renewables based on this research by Ken Caldera at the Carnegie Institution for Science and three other fellow researchers. Ken, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.